You're listening to the Reinvest Podcast, where each Tuesday we will show you how to reclaim, reconnect, and refocus your life by bringing you the top real estate professionals in the industry. We'll pull back the curtain so you can implement these tools and tactics to build generational wealth. Your hosts, Garrett Gatton and Seth Simonillo. Welcome, welcome to another episode of Reinvest Podcast. This is the show where Seth and I pull back the curtain on all things real estate investing so that you can figure out how to maximize your life through the power of what we call real estate.
I like it. Yeah. We should have that in like our title or something.
We'll have to put that before a committee here. So we do have a great guest today, Drew Brenneman with Brenneman Capital. A lot of interesting things. Drew, I'll give you a chance to say hi to our audience here.
Hey, what's going on, everybody?
That's it. We can go home now. So just to come out swinging, I think this is a fun anecdote. I'm sure that you get asked a lot about, but you're on HGTV. Okay. A lot of people don't know that. So talk to us about what was that? What was the scenario that even created that to happen?
And when was that?
Yeah, it would have been 2005, like in the April-ish, because that's when I bought my first place, and it was
How old were you?
19.
19.
So, yeah, I like the banter rapport you guys have, or this is a fun podcast, I can tell already. So,
just at a lunch, and one of our clients was like, you guys are an awful married couple, and I don't know if that's a compliment or not, but
we're not a married couple.
That's true, we're not. Yeah, got great wives.
Gotta keep that clear. But yeah, so yeah, home and garden, how I kind of fell into that. I didn't want to do it, but then I my mom and my realtor were like, why would you not want to do it? And I eventually was like, all right, yeah, why not? But I started this internet business in high school, saved all the money from that, and was looking at what's the best investment I could make, and realized that's going to be real estate. And I'm from the Milwaukee area, and then I was going to go to college at UW-Madison. So I figured out, I've already invested in mutual funds and stocks. I don't really like how this is out of my control and everything. I'm going to invest in real estate when I go to Madison and buy student rentals. So at least I was thinking just one at the time. I ended up buying four. But so when I was a freshman, I got a realtor. We started looking at deals and I bought a duplex, and then I house hacked it, even though it's funny as this is I guess feel like I'm getting older. That was before house hacking, the term was, I think, invented yet.
Back in my day, they didn't call it house
hacking. Yeah, we call that just living in it. But now now it's, I was house hacking. And then, I think Brandon Turner was asking me, what should I call this? And I said, just go with house hacking. So.
Yeah, you were the one that, were the power behind the throne.
Yeah, but now that's... it worked out great. You know, moved into it, rented out the upstairs unit. I had two friends lined up to live in it with me. One of them never asked their parents. So then when he did ask his parents about it, they said, no, you got to live in the dorms. So I remember thinking like, what the heck? And like, I just bought this whole house and like you like are backing out now. So we found a random gal from Craigslist to be our third roommate.
That couldn't go wrong.
Yeah. So, and it was, you know, all good. She paid the rent and it worked out. But that was it. So I was off and going. And then, Home and Garden came to like the local brokerage offices just to like realtors, and was asking, not to like the commercial brokerages, I don't think they were doing a show on like what you get for the money in different housing markets at different price points. So I was on an episode where it was, you know, like Madison, Wisconsin, and Los Angeles, and then some other cities. So it was interesting, like for a quarter million, I had a five bedroom house, you know, but five bedrooms and, you know, parking in a yard. And then like when they got to LA, it was like, here's like the smallest, worst studio you've ever seen. Yeah. With no parking and everything. So
that's funny.
So it was fun. It's the only time I had been on TV, and it's kind of funny because you're on TV for, you know, 90 seconds or whatever, but you spend like all day shooting it. So it's like, all right, the producer he's in your dorm room with the camera and sound guy. And they're like, all right, walk in and throw your backpack down on the bed and then sit down on the computer. Then you do it. And then, then he's like, all right, well, walk down. You got to like walk in a little quicker this time, and then face the camera. And then, cause it's funny being on TV where you don't just talk to someone face to face. Like you actually stand towards the camera. So then it's like, you know, you're talking to somebody, but you're looking at the camera. It's kind of weird, right. Or looking more, standing more open, we'll say.
So right. What did the success do to you? I mean, did you spiral after you started to get all that publicity and stuff?
Yeah.
But I am curious though, what was the other side of that? I mean, did you have friends be like, oh my gosh, man, great. Or was it just your mom and your realtor being like, that was the coolest 90 seconds ever?
I think, well, it's funny at that point. I mean, really everyone I had gone to high school with in college, they knew I was just a little different. So where, you know, I never really talked about getting a job. I always had like a business, doing something, making money. You know, I was just always the most entrepreneurial person or would, you know, and so I don't think anybody was really surprised. I'll say it was more just, they thought it was awesome. And, you know, one of my friends, Rob, was able to somehow record it from the TV. This is before like it was like digital or online at all. So like I have a copy of that. I'm still not sure how he figured out how to record it, but I'm glad
he did. Was that called TiVo? Wasn't there a thing where you could record cable television and all the rich kids had it?
Well, somehow he got it where it's a file now on the computer even. So that's where I'm like, I don't know. I think TiVo, that was like the first DVR. And then, you know, but it's just for watching TV. Somehow he got it where like it's saved on my Dropbox on my computer. Like I have the file.
He was probably the same kid that used LiveWire to illegally download music. So,
So fast forward from that, you continued on in real estate in some way, form or fashion, right? You said you ended up having 4 student rentals. Do you still have any of those?
I don't. I sold the last one in 2017. But yeah, to kind of bring it maybe more current. So yeah, I had bought 4 deals when I was in college, you know, that first duplex, then another duplex, and sold the first one and bought 2-3 units. It's just interesting to think back how I bought those, where one was an ad in the newspaper. Another one was I bought it just off a guy who put a sign in his yard. You know, so still, yeah. And looking at rent comps, you know, you were looking at, in these like for rent books, magazines, but they did not have pictures. So I remember being a little worried on the first deal that I bought, cause they had a 3-bed, 1-bath as well, going for a lot less than I had estimated. And I got really worried. And kind of what's funny about it today is like, there's no pictures. I have no idea what it was like. And then I figured out what it was like then. Like, yeah, that is this way worse property. And of course, it's $200 cheaper. It needs to be demoed and like a full gut rehab, this thing.
So Drew, how old are you now?
37.
Okay. What's so funny about this is like, because you're technically considered a millennial.
Am I?
Yeah, I think you are. I think you're on like the upper end of being a millennial. And it's funny now, we're honestly at the age where it's like you look back and you say things like, oh yeah, we would like call on a rotary phone or we would look at magazines. And now it sounds so old to say that stuff.
Yeah. And I know I have a 5-year-old son and he asked me which iPad I had when I was a kid. and I was like, I remember when that was invented.
It's called a BlackBerry.
Yeah. I told him the kind of games we played. It was called a coloring book. When I was a kid, I would be at my grandma's house. We would look out the window and try to guess what color car would come by next. Like that's what I was doing. I wasn't watching trick shot videos on YouTube or whatever.
Yeah, dude, perfect. That's hilarious.
So, so now that you are the founder of Brenneman Capital and you guys specialize in multifamily syndications, you guys, it looks like from doing some snooping on your website, you guys manage over $200 million in assets under management.
Correct. Yeah. And those are all deals that I sourced and like it's not like a bunch of like co-GPs grouping up together to buy where those are just all deals that I've done over the last 15 or so years. And then really early on, the whole business was built just really 2 investors. I had one investor initially where I bought $100 million of property with him. I still own most of it. And he didn't invest like $30 million or whatever would be a normal down payment on that. It was more, you know, we bought deals one at a time, then we would either refinance out equity, buy another, or sell it and 1031
the capital.
Yeah, into bigger. So that we built that up over the last 15, 20 years, and then found another kind of similar guy, a former trader, and then partnered up with his son-in-law as well. And we bought plus or minus $100 million in Chicago and Phoenix as well. But while I was working with those two families, you know, I'd have people come up that would want to invest in syndications, if or could they put 50 grand in or 100, and I'd actually turn them away because I would say, well, I don't have any, like, it's literally just me. I find the deals, I do them. Then actually then the investors, they're both of them, their daughters ended up working for us, still do, in the business doing accounting for those deals. And so, like, I'm not even set up with like the right systems or anything where you know, my reporting is just, well, just let me know if you have a question or ask your daughter. And then they, you know, they got the answer. So in 2021, I repositioned the business. I hired some additional staff to have an asset manager now, accounting, and two acquisitions guys, plus me. And we also repositioned sort of all the deals I had been doing. It was Wisconsin, Minnesota, Illinois, which is where I had only lived in those places, doing mostly multifamily, but also we had done commercial, so industrial, office, retail, strip center, small shop stuff, and really just sort of committed to focusing on multifamily and then figuring out where is going to be the best markets to invest. And so then we have, you know, we've settled on Phoenix, Dallas, and Austin as the places we want to be investing. We've bought 5 or 6 deals in Phoenix the last couple of years, and then I moved actually last month from Chicago to Austin, Texas.
Oh, wow.
I'm a Texan now. I need to get a Texas flag or something behind me here.
People take that seriously in Texas. Yeah, they're
very proud. It's great.
Are you wearing cowboy boots yet?
So the I think, that's, I haven't, it's pretty warm for cowboy boots for me, but that's, you know. But yeah, that's, so no, I think, Texas has been great. It's interesting. There's just a lot of pride, you know, being here for being in Texas.
It feels like they treat it like it's a different country. I mean, they feel like there's like a patriotic, nationalistic kind of sense for the state of Texas.
Yeah. And it's great being here, and people are proud of what they're doing. And, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people, when I was living in Chicago, they're making excuses for Illinois and kind of feel like they're on defense or need to explain. You know, I tell people I just moved from Chicago, and I feel like I need to give a disclaimer, like, don't worry, I'm not gonna, you know, XYZ, it's all good, you know. But it's, you know, so they, so it's funny, because that's like, I, you know, you're almost a bit on sort of defense, where I would living in Illinois, I wasn't proud of a lot of things the state or the city of Chicago was doing, at all. So
yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's a whole topic there of being an investor, an entrepreneur, very capitalistically minded in a blue city. You know what I mean? And there's a whole lot there that we could get into. But really, the meat and potatoes of today, which I'm excited about, Drew, is figuring out how you guys are exploiting technology and resources, kind of twofold. One, to close off-market deals. And then secondly, how to implement that through the whole transaction lifecycle of real estate, from identifying markets to underwriting to management and buy and hold. So I guess just kick us off, man, about what does it look like for you guys to utilize tech in the real estate sector?
And I think how I think about this is a couple ways, and it's maybe a broader answer to start, but like, there's a lot of companies that invest in real estate, a lot of companies that invest in multifamily, obviously. So then what's going to differentiate us, or be like, what could we do to set ourselves apart, give us an edge? It's interesting that the investor I have in Chicago, he's a former trader. And on every deal, he asks the same question, like, what's our edge in this deal? And if you told him, like, well, we just, there was a, it was for sale with a broker, and there were 3 rounds of bidding, and we're paying the most, like, he'd be like, that doesn't sound like a great deal. But no, we got sent this deal off market. We have to assume their loan, which is not a favorable rate right now, but we're getting it at a really great price because of that. And we're the only bidder. Well, that's the kind of deals we were buying in Chicago, and what he liked. And so that we're kind of just continuing with that with Brenneman Capital, where we've been, you know, figured what could we specialize in. And really what we've specialized in is off-market deal flow, for one, to your point, and then the use of technology. But what's interesting with the and we did specialize in product type and markets, where I'm investing only in multifamily, but not just everywhere, where probably before, if someone would have sent me a deal in, you know, outside of those 3 cities I mentioned, I still look at it and go, you never know. Now I've realized that's a waste of time. Like, I don't know those markets well. We don't have a good way to run them. Whereas we already have, you know, people we work with in Phoenix. I already live in Austin. Like, let's stick to our advantages. But how I've, 80% of the deals I bought, and I only know this because I counted it up when we redid our website, but 80% of the deals I bought have been either off market or off market through a broker or from a repeat seller.
Interesting.
And so, and only two of the deals, and I think I bought about 40 properties, 40 assets, let's call it, different purchases. Only two of those were us winning a best and final situation, like what I joked about. And then, all the others were bought another way. But at the deal sizes we're buying, which, traditionally, if someone asked, what am I buying? I'd say 2 to 8 million. And now we're in a little bit bigger, 5 to 50. Let's call it, but the biggest deal we bought is 33 million. So let's say 5 to 33. Mm-hmm. Almost all those deals, they have brokers attached to them in some capacity.
Right.
Brokers do get higher prices. They create a market for the property. They know what things are worth. So the people that own these properties are smart, and they're working with a broker. Where we've kind of came into the fold is, let's say that loan assumption deal I was kind of half joking about, where that was a real deal we bought. We did in 2019 and in 2020, I forgot the years each closed, we did 4 loan assumption purchases.
Wow.
Because I mean, cap rates, were more or less at all time lows. Interest rates were, were in the high threes. It was people were paying such crazy numbers for stuff. So then the deals that worked for us were, two of those loan assumptions were repeat sellers as well. So guys we had done deals with before. And then they said, I have this property, but I have this, Freddie Mac loan on it. The rate's in the mid fours, so the rate sucks. It's funny now how things change.
Wild.
But at the time, when you could get a 3.6% or whatever rate, that's a 20% higher interest rate to be in the mid fours. What would you pay for this? And we're literally the only ones bidding on it, going, yeah, I know you wanted $16 million when you had it on the market before you refied, but the most we pay is 13. And we bought that deal for $13,150,000. He's like, just add on the, after wearing him down, he's like, just add on the broker fee and let's roll.
No way. So, okay. And then, this is great. Hold on. Let me pause you right there. Cause really to get into the weeds on this, what would cause a seller? Cause I'm trying to think of our audience, how somebody could be in a scenario where they would have such a good experience with a seller one time that a seller would then come back and choose exclusively to do business with you and not put it on the open market. Why wouldn't they just list it with a broker to drive the price up?
Well, usually there's some reason to be sending it to us. It's not where they're thinking this, if it goes in the open market, someone's going to make an offer on it. We're going to proceed, but then they're not going to be capable of assuming this loan. They're going to run into some snag or say, oh, this is actually too much work, I don't want to deal with it. Where at that point, I counted up also how many agency loans I had done. And I was like, here, we've done probably at that time, 25 of them. Here is sort of, we've done this. We know what they're going to ask for. Mm. And we actually used the same debt guy, Steve Kundert at CBRE, to get to Freddie and Fannie. So mm-hmm. he literally used the same guy. I've done 8 deals with the same broker. It's where it's the certainty of close. And one thing where I did a I guess just to make sense, I have a podcast too, and where it's the Brenneman Blueprint, and I did an episode on skills you need to, or skills you'd want to build in real estate. And one of my favorite sort of clip we pulled from that episode is I'm saying, you need to build a reputation as a closer. And if a broker sends you a deal and it's what you want, you need to buy it. That's essentially the whole clip. And I like it because it's so simple. And I sent it to a couple brokers and they're like, oh, this is great. Cause they, but you say, I want to buy this kind of property. Then you get sent it and then you go do the inspection and it's a, you're nickel and diming them over little stuff. And it's when I go to the property, I'm actually looking at it, I don't know, fully, not inspecting it obviously, but if I'm not going to go there and then go, I look at the masonry or the exterior. I'm thinking Chicago. I'm look at the windows, the porches, the as much as I can and what I see, because I don't want to go there and be like, oh yeah, I guess I didn't notice that there's like a ton of brickwork needed, or I never bothered asking what's the roof like. I try to get as much of that to figure it out ahead of time, so there's not all these surprises. So it's been extremely rare that I've ever asked for a credit buying a property or tried to retrade on price. It's only happened when there's been a misalignment of what I was told. On the one of the deals I bought, a shopping center, we were told the rents were one number. On a tenant, they were not. So we just adjusted the price based on the difference in rents.
Right.
Another one I bought, I was told the roof is new. And I swear to God, it was like 20 years old and needs to be replaced.
Newer than what it was built.
No, we, I don't know if they just were not that smart and thought like painting the roof was replacing it or what. Because it's one of those flat roofs where you hit it with that elastomeric paint or whatever. Mm-hmm. But anyways, it was, you know, it's just things like that. And I've sold property and these folks are asking for, you know, just the tiniest stuff, like one deal. Actually, I should probably not get into that and be putting somebody on blast here. But it's like they're asking for tiny stuff that's almost like maintenance items. And it's like, yeah, so I wouldn't call them back and be like, hey, you should look at this other one. I would go, right. I'm thinking, thank God they're paying the most because this is like a pain.
Yeah.
So,
The golden goose. I mean, you know, so Seth and I are full-time commercial real estate agents, and that's our 9-to-5. That's our bread and butter. And everything you're saying is 100% true. And we'll have clients or we'll be involved in a transaction where that's the mindset. It's like death by 1,000 cuts. And people don't, it's like they're so focused on the transaction. They can't zoom out to see that they're putting a relationship in jeopardy that could pay them dividends in years to come in future transactions. And at the end of the day, $5,000 credit on a couple $1 million, you know, purchase price acquisition is not worth missing out on deals in the future because you burn a bridge with the broker. So
exactly anyway. Right. And then, you don't want to be a pushover. If there's a real problem, you should bring it up and, or even, you know, with the broker, you know, commissions and fees, we'll pay market, but we don't overpay. Let's say that's something worth, I'll say we're like, how do we get the deals? It wasn't like we were adding in extra money to get it or anything, but also I'm not killing them on the fee. Like, oh, I think it needs to be this and want to break a record for lowest commission they've ever received or anything. I at this point I've seen enough deals sell and talk to enough brokers, you know, sell. Cause I have to see the settlement statement then. And talking to brokers where I have, and I know it's market for the different price points, and I just want to pay that. I don't want to overpay, but I definitely don't want to underpay where then they're thinking, oh, great, Drew's bidding on this and going to be asking, or, you know, yeah, you want to list it, but then we got to, you know, have this long drawn out fee thing. So yeah, you want to take care of your brokers. I mean, they're driving the, you know, your deal flow in large part on these bigger deals. You know, we've tried cold calling owners and we've done that. I did buy one deal where I cold called my neighbor on a deal I owned in Minnesota, and he did sell to us. But before selling, he got a broker because he was just he had an automotive business. It wasn't like a real estate guy. So you know, we haven't had a lot of success in the fully off market channels. It's because a lot of these people, they bought with a broker, they want to sell with the same one, or they think they want to expose it to the whole market. And then they go, well, wait, this has this loan assumption. And to actually answer, I think you're asking it, why would someone take a lower price like that? Well, the prepayment penalty on that $13 million deal, it was like $2 million. So to him, he's going, I'm getting 13. They're assuming my loan. That's like me selling it to 15, you know, for 15 to the next, you know, random person off the street who doesn't want to assume this.
Take it out from underneath.
And, you know, he didn't want to do it at first, but he had some developments that he was building and wanted the money for that, and eventually did. And that's kind of been mostly the story. On a lot of the deals I bought, they're perfectly good deals. They just have a better use of the money. A lot of buying from a lot of developers.
Yeah, so. No, and that's true. Timing is huge. And that's why it's good to keep rapport with people. You know, don't get discouraged if you make a cold call. It doesn't go anywhere. Like, drip on people, build that rapport and that relationship. Get that long view in mind and it will convert with you eventually. You know, we just closed a mobile home park and the guy could have sold it for more money on the open market, but certainty of clothes. We're local guys. It was a legacy property for him, passed on to him from his father. So he wanted to know that the next operators were going to have the same diligence and care that he had with it. And he rolled out the red carpet on seller finance terms for it. You know, so those do exist out there. And you got to kind of have the right principles. Being a closer is great. So let's pivot. That's kind of the relational side of sourcing deals. What about technology? How are you guys using that in identifying deals, lead funnel?
Yeah. So in terms of the, we've spent a lot on technology, but some of the best stuff that we've done, actually, we've just made internally, but we use Juniper Square for our investor portal. We were using Salesforce for a CRM. I mean, we have CoStar and Yardi and for pulling in data. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of RedIQ, but that's sort of where our underwriting starts. Where it's a tool that uses AI that you can pull in even PDFs of financials or Excel files.
Wow!
And then the AI piece is it learns how you categorize them in your underwriting. So let's say some people think of a good example. Some places, and for some owners, some lenders, trash removal, some it's a contract, some it's utility. So mm-hmm. It would learn how you do it. Let's say I'm buying a deal from you guys, would take your financials and would automatically organize them how we do. And then you check it, you know, you want it, you kind of give the final sign off in each category. And then, so now all the financials are moved into our format. What you do is you click a button from RedIQ and then it puts it into our model from in Excel. And then from there, the Excel model we have built, I hired a guy who worked at a $50+ billion private equity place. Wow. And when he was working there, he was using their model and was like, you know, I could just make a better one. We're doing all these side calcs and things. So during COVID, he just built a new model where the information flows freely through it. So you import that and almost your whole model is filled out. And then you got to adjust a lot of things because you don't have your deal populated yet. But anyways, so that model is, you know, now ours and we've improved it a lot since he made it.
Did you say that you're giving it out for free?
I did not. I think it's the way... We would need a video series to explain how to use it. Where
I bet, dude,
some of those models get so complex.
Yeah, it's easy to use, I guess, once you've been using it for a while. But there's so many bells and whistles in it that it's a lot to take in. But so we have a really great underwriting system using that. But what's the best part about it is. And this is something we developed after he started working for us. So even that private equity place doesn't have this, where we then click a button from that model and it pulls 900 different data points out of the model. Like what did you assume per unit for insurance or for real estate taxes? It pulls out all the different variables you'd want and it puts them into a database that we have that's also in Excel. We like using Excel because it's so easy to run calcs and look at the data. And then what we do with that is then we have a database of every deal that's, sold in our markets. So we've underwrote it. We can see what the real cap rates are. Cause I mean,
the broker
oftentimes, performer. I was going to say, you guys are brokers. Sometimes these cap rates,
hit us.
So what we've, realized is kind of like, we have what we think the cap rates are on it. Brokers, they don't want to overestimate what, or undershoot what the NOI would be. They aren't, padding the expenses like a, an owner would. rightfully so. You guys want to, get people to look at it and don't want to, want to show a rosy scenario. Makes sense.
We would never do that. But other brokers out there, I'm tracking 100% with you.
Yeah. So we have that in there. But the most important part is then our underwriting is standardized. Let's say we're looking at let's say it's a townhome deal in Phoenix. So we then filter in our database for those kind of deals and go, well, we like this deal. Let's find out why. And we go, and you can look at it and go, oh, well, we're underwriting less payroll, less repairs, less everything on this deal. That's why we like it. Dude, let's go back crazy. And kind of get it more in line with what, we thought it was before, or double check why should this be lower.
So every deal you underwrite in a market goes into the database and that becomes a benchmark for you for new deals that you underwrite to compare against the other ones, right? So it's like, man,
correct.
The last 10 deals in Phoenix that we underwrote, it was all 3 cap. and this is a four cap. Wow, we're actually coming out ahead. Why? And then it breaks it down and shows, hey, they're billing back more, you know, utilities, and their repair costs is less per year. And
that's exactly right. So it's really great to compare and keep track of what's going on in the market. And then, because usually when you underwrite deals, and I mean, until we had this, I was doing the same thing, and it's what everyone's doing. You underwrite a deal, you decide you're not going to proceed with it. You just leave it saved in that file in your computer, in that folder in your computer forever, and you probably never look at it again.
Yeah. Correct.
And certainly don't dig into, like, what did I assume for insurance, you know, a year ago on something I looked at. And
so why not,
this is all in front of you.
Why not just use the Yardies of the world and the CoStars of the world to pull that data for a market? Why do you feel like you need to have your own data accessible? Because that's a lot of work. I mean, now that you've built the system, it's probably not as much work to do. You're underwriting it anyway. But that was probably a huge investment of time and capital.
Yeah, it was. I mean, but I don't, you know, only Yardie, I think, has expense info. Like, if you're going down to, like, the property level, like what's in this, or maybe Trepwood if it's a loans in there. But a lot of the information we're tracking, it's not available. I mean, CoStar, they'll have things like average rents in a market, units, units in a market, supply, vacancy, you know, past rent growth, predicted future rent growth. But yeah, they wouldn't tell you, like, what was the underwritten, you know, repair and maintenance per unit for this. And the way a lot of these places, and, you know, it's CoStar included, is their cap rate information on a sale, it's through a verbal survey. So, like, they call you.
And, yeah, they call. We've had those calls before.
Yeah, or the owner. And I mean, I'm not joking. I mean, if someone calls me and is like, what's a cap rate? I'll just add 100% on, you know, like, it's a seven cap, you know, and this is like kind of half joking, see if they'll put it in there. Cause it's, why would we be explaining this to CoStar?
Right.
Doesn't make sense. So anyway, so we have real, you know, data that we've made and, you know, from deals we've underwritten. So it's helped for that. And then too, I mean, where the data's helped a lot too, to keep going on this thread here, is with market selection. So we also made a market appreciation model. So we took the largest 50 or so markets and pulled every relevant data point that we could from 2000 to 2023. And actually then we have, it predicts out to 2025. So we have data for that too. We're just by zip code, population information, incomes, job growth, just new supply, just everything you could get. And most of this information is pulled from Yardie, CoStar, and then somewhere we were able to buy the census data by zip code where they had broken it out. Something Explorer was the name of that one. And so really what it does is it understands the economic and, like, demographic and apartment fundamentals for each market, understands the new supply picture. And what we did was go back and figure out what is correlated with appreciation and what's not, and actually go and solve for what are the correlations. Mm-hmm. And the same guy who made that underwriting model, his hobby is sports analytics. So he's done this before for the NCAA tournament, for making he calls it a bracket optimization model. And that model, he does like to pass out to people. So if you guys want it, just let me know. So it's interesting because he knows how to do this. So he knows what's most correlated with, winning in, let's say, college basketball. And I did something with him on, we were talking about it, and same thing. He was talking about, it's like, it's three pointers were like the least correlated. And it was like, it was interesting. I think it was the pace of play and, like, turnovers were the most correlated, or something where it wasn't even points. It was like, just, if they play fast, they get a lot of opportunities, and obviously turnovers are important. But so we basically did that with understanding the apartment markets, what's correlated, what's not, the top correlated things with the highest correlation. And just to back up too, because some of these terms were, both my parents were teachers. So a lot of times I'll start talking about this stuff and then they're like, what's an IRR or what's a, you know, whatever equity multiple. But a correlation, like if it has a high correlation, it means the two items move together similarly. So if a correlation was 1.0, it would mean, you know, thing one moves exactly like thing two if the correlation was 1.0. If the correlation zero means they don't move at all in any relationship together. And if it's minus one, they move exactly the opposite.
Are there correlations I mean, can you give a couple of examples for correlations, property specific and then market specific?
I don't know if we have anything property specific. I would, in terms of what was the most correlated with prices going up on multifamily, it was job growth as a percentage and population growth as a percentage. Mm-hmm. So, which sounds obvious, but what's the big insight in that for me is, let's say people, like the most common negative comment, let's say about Phoenix from like an apartment market is new supply, mm-hmm. too much new supply. And they're just easy to build. Same thing with, you know, a lot of the Sun Belt, Texas, there's a lot of building.
Right.
But supply was one of the least correlated things with the prices going up.
Interesting.
And yeah, and you start to think about it and you go, well, okay, it kind of makes sense. Probably in the Class A product, it has a higher correlation because you're directly competing. But one example, after he had explained this to me, the most recent deal we bought in Phoenix, it was built like, you know, 30 years ago. We rent our two bedrooms out for $1,800, $1,850.
Wow, that's
crazy. And the new building across the corner, though, they go for $2,650. The same, you know, plus parking and amenities
mix.
Yeah. So a two bed, two bath compared to our two bed, two bath.
That's sassy.
Obviously, theirs is way nicer, and you know, ours is renovated, so it still has in-unit laundry. Anyways, point being, if they build another one on the other corner across from us, is that really going to impact our building? You know, right. it's so much more money. I don't feel like people are going to be like, oh, I'll just pay another
$800.
Yeah, 50% more to be in that deal, and same thing vice versa. If you can afford $2,650 and you're used to a brand new product and parking in a garage, you know, our deal, you're parking outside and it, you know, it's renovated, but it, you know, feels different. So,
right.
That was probably a big insight. I thought, cause then it's a little more easy to pick the markets. Then you see where are the jobs and the people going. And, you know, mm-hmm. In terms of just speaking broadly, you know, Denver and Salt Lake, they had a big boom, but now I've kind of slowed. And also another thing we found is just something that was really correlated with also rents going up and then the prices going up for multifamily values, just the rent amount in just in raw numbers. So like if I had no more info and it was like in one market the average rent is 1,000 and the other one it's 2,000, the one that's only 1,000 is a lot more likely to go up. Both rents and value, which makes sense. People like mm-hmm. in, you know, the Bay Area, even if that didn't have other headwinds, it's like they're already paying 50% of their incomes on average in rent. So it makes sense. Like if that grows slower than a place like Phoenix, which at the time when we were doing this, people are paying like 20% on average. Where it's like that, then that rent feels low.
Right.
So those are the biggest takeaways. And then, yeah, we did make something where we take these variables and then try to, give a property specific location score as well. And that just kicks out one number. If the location, how above average or below average this location is based on the same factors. And then we made maps of the cities that color code kind of where the best locations are. And so that was sort of the, so there's no insight really on the property thing, but it's more, we figured out a way to kind of without any bias, like score an area. So,
wow.
Yeah,
wow,
that's crazy. That's some good stuff. Somehow our time has like just evaporated. So we're going to move forward to our smaller pocket segment. Drew, go ahead and tell us, what was one of your worst real estate deals? What went wrong? And then most importantly, what did you learn from it for our audience?
Really two things in it. That come to mind. On the second deal I bought in Madison, I did not do really much of any due diligence on it. Let's say when we were under contract, from a, like what is legally there right now standpoint. And so I thought I was buying, because this is how it was advertised and how it was rented out, a duplex where the first floor was a 4-bedroom and the second floor was a 2-bedroom. And so I bought it just without like pulling the city records or looking into it or anything. Whereas in, a lot of states, you can do a freedom of information request. You know, I don't know what it is where you guys are, but when I was buying those deals in Chicago, every deal, first thing you do is submit the FOIA. Even if I'm not buying it, I'm just still underwriting it, getting close, so I'll get the FOIA in early. And turned out two of those bedrooms on the first floor were actually not legal bedrooms. They were just dens. So
wow.
So then I got, I, it was, I, and so how the person I bought it from had rented it out was actually by the bedroom. So then I got burned on that because the people that were in the dens were able to just break their lease and go, because I'm not renting them a legal space. So that ended up just being kind of a temporary setback, though. I mean, how you handle something like that, if anyone's in a similar situation where some of the space may not be like fully legally conforming, you just are renting out the entire space then. So I never rented anything by the bedroom again at that building, or actually never anywhere. So what I did was from then on, I'm just renting out the whole unit. I'm advertising it as a two bed, two den, two bathroom. It's just the whole space, these two floors, and this is what the rent is. Later on, I bought a property that was similar where I had expanded into the basement. Same thing. I didn't say, hey, this basement bedroom, I'll sign a lease with you. It was just, you're renting these two floors. You can use it. The max that the city allows, five people in here. So we just can only do five on a lease, but the city comes knocking, they're going to enforce, they're enforcing all the rules. So they then, you know, so I was up front with everybody in those student rentals from there. But so that was kind of my, one of my bigger mistakes, I'd say, especially early on.
One of those kind of ones that hides in the background. Mm-hmm. And that's where you just have to be doing real estate long enough to get some reps in and figure out what you can and cannot do. Because local laws are so different,
right? They're so area specific.
Federal, state, local, you got townships, you've got city limits. I mean, there's a lot of nuances depending on where you're investing. So, but that changed your investment strategy though, right? Because they're like, moving forward, I'm not going to get burned like this again. So,
yeah. And it's also too, I mean, you can, you know, learn by doing, you know, at that point. So I ended up getting an undergrad degree in real estate and then worked at other places. And so I would have learned this eventually, you know, probably, but since I was a 19-year-old buying property, I just knew what I knew from talking to my realtor and reading books on investing in real estate. And I guess I didn't, I never got to the due diligence paragraph.
There's no bigger pockets back then, that. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just the blog. Just guys, you know, Brandon and the other guy writing. So
that's wild. All right, man, we're going to go into what we call our little nugget. So, Drew, what is one practical takeaway piece of advice that our listeners can implement to their real estate investing businesses?
Well, I think the most important metric to focus on is your unlevered yield on cost. And compare that to what the prevailing cap rate is in the market. So unlevered yield on cost, that would be, you know, it's sort of your cap rate in the future, like assuming today's assumption. So let's say you're doing a deal where you need to do a little bit of renovation, and then you think you can get the rents to a new number. So you're taking your future NOI, but not assuming additional like market growth. Just if it was all done today, my new NOI will be Y. And my purchase price plus my cost to get it there will be this other number. You divide the future NOI by your all-in basis, and then that's your yield on cost. And I think that's the easiest thing. That's the best metric, because IRR and these other things, that has a lot to do with the timing of when things happen. Right. Where this is just saying things I normally sell, let's say, for a 6 cap in this market. But I buy this, I make these two moves, and then I'll be all in at like a 7 cap on the unlevered yield on cost. I mean, that's easy to wrap your head around. I like to keep things simple and go like it's be really hard to lose money on that deal that I just described. And then how much you make and what your IRR is will be to depend on, you know, the timing of things and what's the cap rate going to be when you sell and all this other stuff. What's your refi loan going to look like? But that's, I like that. And it's, you know, but the important thing is to use today's assumptions, where I don't do that and then think, and I'll grow the rents 10% in the meantime, you know. It's just
right.
It's just using today's times. Like, yeah. So what am I, do I have a buffer built in?
So you're stripping away some of the assumptions and variables that people normally make in underwriting over a 5-year hold, and just saying, let's boil it all down, brass tacks. What do I have? What am I really buying? What's the substance of it today? Because I don't know really what the market's going to do in 5 years. So it gives you that snapshot, not a snapshot picture, but an understanding of the bones of the investment.
That's right. And of course, we still underwrite it. So if someone wanted to know what would be your 5-year returns, we'd have that. But in terms of, if someone said, what metric do you look at the most on any given deal? It would be the unlevered yield on cost compared to the cap rate today.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. So just in closing, man, what's been one of the greatest resources in your real estate investing career? And then how can people follow your success?
I think, I mean, if the best resource really, I guess, would be as I got going, I learned a lot through podcasts, and I really liked the Fort with Chris Powers and the Old Capital podcast. Mm. If you're like a newer investor, it's Investing in Real Estate by Gary Eldred. That's the first book I read and kind of when the light bulb went off for me. So very simple and got a, oh, it was a really good starting point. And then, yeah, if you want to, follow me on social media, I'm at Drew Brenneman everywhere. I have the Brenneman Blueprint, which is a real estate investing podcast that's for active and passive real estate investors. Are people looking to invest in real estate, kind of see what it all entails. And then if you want to be a passive investor in our deals, so someone who would just invest in them, you don't have to do any work. You just throw money in and sign your name a few times and you own a piece of the deal. You can go to Brenneman.com, B as in boy, R-E-N-E-M-A-N. And that's the Brenneman Capital website. And we also have a passive investing guidebook that you can download for free on our website. So
awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you. We'll get all that stuff in the show notes, all the links for our guests.
Real quick before we close, how did you get Brenneman.com? That had to be taken.
It was. Yeah. I bought it off a guy who went to Stanford and he said he obtained it in the 80s. And
wow.
So no, I bought it off him. So.
Was that cheap? Was that not cheap?
It was not cheap. You know, it sounds like he has a lot of money and didn't want to sell it. But I was, I wanted it, and you know, it's, you can make a good amount of money in real estate. So it was worth it.
That's awesome.
Wild. So,
well, what a good way to end, dude, thank you for coming on today. We're excited to be able to share this with our audience and, yeah, man, we'll continue to follow your success.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
As always, excited that you joined us on another episode of the Reinvest Podcast. If this episode added to your tool belt or left you feeling inspired, go ahead and share it with a friend. Stay tuned every Tuesday for new episodes. And if you want to get in touch with us, go to our LinkedIn or Facebook profiles and shoot us a message. Move farther, reach higher, and grow deeper. See you next time.